question was asked, many of the rabbinic institutions which we adhere to today, what we call mitzvot rabbanan, takanot, gzeirot, really are institutions from thousands of years ago, right? Hanukkah. It's been over 2,000 years since the rabbis instituted Hanukkah. Purim, you're closer to the 2,500-year mark. So what's going on that we are maintaining the institutions of the rabbis from so long ago today?
What the question is, why do we live our lives by the way you said it, random people throughout the years?
Okay, so it's not random people. I'm saying that when Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, so we have a pasuk that says, "Al pi haTorah asher yoruha." So the Torah defines for us that there is a concept of the rabbinic responsibility for interpreting the Torah. Meaning there's the written Torah, there's the tradition of the Torah, and then there's the rabbinic interpretation, which is sometimes d'oraita, sometimes biblical, and sometimes rabbinic, and we're not always sure which way it is. Meaning some things that the rabbis told us, we're not sure if what they told us is biblical or rabbinic. We're not always sure. That's the question sometimes in the Gemara and in the Rishonim of, is it an asmachta? Did the rabbis mean it as a derivation or not? One example of that is our tefillah in Rosh Hashanah, where we say, Malchuyot Zichonot Shofarot. There are certain additions in our tefillah, and the Gemara in one place seems to talk about it being d'oraita, biblical, and in other places the Gemara clearly says it's rabbinic, and the question is, how do you justify the two? So, the first thing is it's not random people. Meaning, in order for a person to be able to be considered that his opinion is worth something, they have to learn, and they have to purify their traits, and they have to learn some more. And then, when they get ordination, that they are qualified as a human being, meaning there has to be a tremendous integrity, honesty, strive for truth. So, when a person is going to get ordination, that they're termed a rabbi in the days of Moshe and in the days of the prophets, Yeshua Shoftim, and in the days of the first Beit HaMikdash and in the days of the Mishnah, getting rabbinic ordination in those days meant you were qualified on a very, very high level, to the point where if they stopped you in the middle of the night and they asked you a question, where does it say how you're supposed to behave with a foreigner who walked into town? Where does it say the blessing on tzitzit? Where does it say hanerot alalu? So even though that's not written in the Shas, it's in the Masechtot HaKtanot, the different things I just mentioned now. One's in Masechet Kala, one's in Masechet Sofrim. We have a few Masechtot Ktanot, what's called the minor tractates. They're not a Braita, they're not in Shas, they're something else. So you have to know even that. Where is the Hanerot Alalu? So in Masechet Sofrim, that's a tractate that's not one of the Shas. So in order to get a rabbinic ordination, you had to be a master of a lot. You really had to know the Shas backwards and forward and a lot, and you had to know the laws of derivation. So it's not random people. It's people who made it to a very high level. Usually it's people who learned for decades and mastered the system. It's not just I learned a few halachot. It's a mastery of the system of the Torah. And that's so the first point is we're talking about very, very high level people. Also high level ethically. Meaning in order for anyone to get smicha, the Gemara says there was once a student who revealed the secret for 20 years. They didn't let him back into the Beis Medrash. He can't be trusted.
Secret?
Yeah, there was a secret. He shouldn't have told. He told the secret. Gamarnu. He can't be a part of the Beis Medrash. He's not qualified. There was a student who did something that the rabbis felt as... We have many stories where the rabbis said, if he's not on the level ethically, he's not a part of this. There's no... That's the story of Yeshu. Yeshu initially was part of the Beit Midrash. And then one time he spoke to his Rebbe about a girl's eyes. And then his Rebbe said, you're looking at girl's eyes. You don't belong here. There's nothing to talk about. You just don't belong here. Go do tshuva. You're not on the level to be learning this type of learning. So people had to be on a very high level ethically, morally, in terms of their midot, and they had to be masters of Torah. And then they could get into this term of being called a Rebbe. Of course, they also had to master Torah in the years where they weren't on such a high level. Abaye and Rava. It says when Abaye used to learn Torah, the Gemara says he'd be concentrating and his thumbs would be under his legs as he was thinking, and they'd start bleeding and he didn't notice. Right? He was focused on his learning, and he didn't notice that the way he was leaning on his thumbs, he caused them to bleed, and he didn't notice because he was so focused. Rava said, if my wife asks me to pass the butter Sunday morning, the whole week's learning is shot. Because their concentration, remember, they learned the Torah about that. Their concentration was, they used to think things through. If you think of a page of Gemara that we learn, they had to think all of that by heart. They had to remember the Mishnah. They had to think through the logic of the Gemara. They had to work out what's really going on here. And all of that was by heart. Remember, none of this was written. None of the Mishnah, none of the Gemara. All of this was by heart. So when they were focused, the level of focus you needed to get to that kind of, you know, who of us knows two pages of Gemara by heart? You know, two pages. Forget Shas Mishnais and Shas Gemara, which was Pashut. You didn't go start anywhere till you knew that. I'm saying, so that's the level they were on. Ah, now that they were on that level and they were pure, so they worked with the system the Torah gives us. And their institutions break down to different types. So you have things which are their definition of Torah. And sometimes that's biblical and sometimes not. Then you have things which are Gzeirot, where they understood that if they don't say these things, then they understood that the people are going to transgress. And the Torah gives them the responsibility. When the Torah says, Ushmaltem et mishmalti, so the Torah says that the rabbis have a responsibility to make gzerot. Now, when the rabbis made gzerot, for example, they said, don't touch a pen on Shabbos because you might come to write. So they made two types of gzerot. There were gzerot they made that they said, this is our generation needs it. It is to be reevaluated at a later date whether it's necessary. Sometimes they made a gzera and they said, here's the reasoning behind it. If the reasoning is no longer relevant, stop the gzera. And sometimes they said, based on our understanding, human nature will falter and this should be forever. And so those are three types of gzerot. There are more types. But they were very careful with their institutions. They were careful so that we would have sometimes the license to undo it and sometimes not. And sometimes they said, we're making a gzera. If at a later date there's a court that feels they're greater than us and they see they should annul it, they can annul it. So there are many systems as to how they made their institutions. And again, this deserves a series. There's gzera, there's takana, there's mitzvah de rabbanan. Lighting Hanukkah candles is a mitzvah de rabbanan. Which again, when they instituted it initially, it was part of a more massive institution of holidays in the second Beit HaMikdash era. And then when the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, they said, okay, We instituted tens of holidays during this era. Of all those holidays, there are two that are eternal. Purim and Chanukah. That was a decision. That was, you could say the decision dates back to the original institution. You could say that was a decision then. But again, you're dealing with a very organized, sophisticated, and responsible system. And one of the things that, to my mind, makes Chazal geniuses on a level that I don't understand, that I just look in awe, was their ability to see beyond the moment. Meaning a part of the genius of Chazal was their understanding of what Hashem wanted, the Torah wanted, and human nature required. And I'll give you a few examples that we don't often think of. The laws of Avelut. Many people marvel when they lose a close relative. They say, it's so amazing how people sit down and they spend 7 days. And that's the healthiest thing psychologically in order to go back to life is to stop and have a mourning period. And today, psychologists are very into this. But you know what? The Torah didn't ordain it. The fact that it'll say at the end of the Chumash of Breshit, Vayas l'aviv evel shivat yamim, Yosef practiced 7 days of mourning for his father, is not a mitzvah. And the Torah does not say you have to sit. The Torah does not or force us, it doesn't obligate us to the concept of 7 days of mourning. That's a rabbinic institution. We rule halachically, it's a machloket, whether the first day, Avelut Yom Rishon, is it Torah or not. That's a machloket in its own right. But everything else is rabbinic, and yet people marvel at it. They say, that's amazing, that's genius. That's Chazal's understanding of what the human being needed. Right, it is. But it's Chazal. The Torah didn't obligate it. The same thing with the 7 days of celebration when people get married. Torah didn't obligate it. The concept of ksuba, that in order for marriage to hold, to last long term, people have to feel a tremendous obligation to it and know that to annul it is a big deal and they're going to have to pay a lot of money. That's a rabbinic institution. And many of the concepts of how our marriage looks is rabbinic. The idea of going to shul 3 times a day and the Shmona Esrei that we daven is rabbinic. Most of what we do throughout our day, most of what we call Jewish living is rabbinic. And Chazal understood the human need. Chazal understood the human development. When Chazal saw an era of almost a millennium where the Jews kept serving Avodah Zarah, so Chazal said, people need a different way of connecting to Hashem. So Chazal said, okay, we're going to organize prayer. There's going to be organized prayer, and this way people won't end up doing Avodah Zarah. And it worked. You see, once they set up the Shemoneh Esrei three times a day, Avodah Zarah disappears from the world. So Chazal understood what the human needs were. The Torah tells you, you have a mitzvah once a day to daven, and the Torah doesn't say Shemoneh Esrei, right? So Chazal said, this is the system and it'll work, and you see it worked. I'm saying, till today it's working. So there are many things that Chazal in their wisdom understood that our human nature requires such. Part of it was a recognition also that times were changing long term. Meaning, one of the things that we marvel at is the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is already over 80 years old. He's an old man. Think Rav Steinman, right? He's an old, old man. He's close to 100. And he's making institutions with a recognition, this is a new era. We're going to have to manage for a long time without a Beit HaMikdash. How do you know that? You know, when the Holocaust came, a lot of people thought, it's just another pogrom. We've had them, they're going to pass, everything's going to be okay. It took great people to recognize this isn't just another pogrom. This is something different. But most people didn't see that. Most people thought this is just a continuation. Why did the Chazon Ish and Rav Shach suddenly invent something that never existed before? Kolel didn't exist. One person in a whole city used to stay learning. You didn't have thousands learning. Didn't exist. They recognized that after the Holocaust, the only way to hold on to Jewish life, and you see they succeeded, is investing in Torah, and suddenly they invented a concept that never existed before. It never existed that everyone went to Kolel, this whole idea. Along came Rav Steinman and said, okay, the era's over. Rav Steinman declared, now we have to start looking at things back, we have to start shifting back to normalcy. But that's a perspective of people who are, they're not biased, they're not working out of personal interest, they have a tremendous understanding of Torah, and they have a tremendous understanding of the ruach, the spirit of what the Torah wants from us. Not everything is just the written law. And the Torah, as the Maharal explains, the Torah built in to the system of the Torah many concepts that the Torah didn't obligate and said, as time passes, the rabbis will decide if and when to institute these things. An example of that is Netilat Yadayim. So the Torah technically only speaks about a human being being totally pure, totally impure. Yet, when the Torah speaks about it, the Torah sometimes uses the term, did you touch something without washing your hands? Our tradition is there's no such concept in Torah. Either the whole body's pure or the whole body's defiled. Nothing in between. It's a rabbinic institution that you wash your hands. So why did the Torah use the terms v'yadav lo shataf b'mayim? He didn't wash his hands. If the Torah didn't mean that, the Torah meant, is the person pure or not? So the Torah was alluding to a concept that the Torah didn't obligate. The Torah alludes to concepts. It says it as a remez. It says, listen, I'm going to describe it this way, so you should infer that this concept is important, but I'm not going to obligate it, and I'm going to leave it to you over time. Initially, many of the halachot, which the rabbis instituted, were initially midat chasidut. The pious people would tovel in mikveh every morning. The pious people would wash their hands before eating. The pious people did it because the Torah taught the concept, but the Torah didn't obligate it. Over time, the rabbis saw that people were not only ready, but needed the rabbinic institution. So the rabbis instituted Netilat Yadayim. Along came Shlomo HaMelech and said, from now on, you don't eat truma, began with holy things, still, without washing your hands. Over time, the rabbis developed it and said everyone should wash their hands before eating. But again, the Torah gave the concept and didn't obligate it. The rabbis, over time, made decisions when the generation was set for it, and they had a system. The truth is that the answer to your question or your cousin's question really requires a series. Understanding the system, understanding why rabbis did what they did and when they did it, it requires a series. But as a brief overview, so we touched on a few points, which I hope will help them understand that there is a system. It's run by very, very responsible, unbiased, pure and holy people who really are working with the system we have from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu already instituted over 3,000 rabbinic institutions. We read in the Torah, right, Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, that's a rabbinic institution by Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbinic institutions began with Moshe. According to some opinions, Moshe Rabbeinu divided our Torah into parshiot. What we call this week's parsha, Parshat Miketz, some say that was Moshe Rabbeinu who gave it the name. We're not sure exactly where it started, but there are different opinions about that as to where it started. But I'm saying rabbinic institutions were par and parcel with the Torah, even in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Was it Ezra that instituted the readings on Fridays, Thursdays, and Shabbos and Shalom?
Ha'isu shlosht yamim velomatzu umayim. Velomatzu umayim, the Gemara says that Moshe Rabbeinu said they went 3 days without Torah. That's the lomatzu umayim.
It says minchas Shabbat.
Right. That's what you're thinking of.
Ezra instituted
Minchas Shabbat. Yeah. So I hope it's enough to give him a starting point. But Bemit, he deserves a series. He's right. It's a big question. Okay.